Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hey, everybody, this is Lee Cantor, and I'm joined in the studio with my good buddy, Mr. Stone Payton. How you doing, Stone?
Good morning, sir. How about that brand new intro? That sounds
rocking and rolling.
I think Trevor and Kevin are on the job with all these
That's
new
what
intros.
What happens? You put 20-year-olds in charge of the music, and it just changes dramatically. You know something?
I know. Hey, nice-looking shirt, man. Are you going somewhere today? What's
That's
the deal?
Right. Tonight is Larry White from the Ritz Group's big event, the Shark... what is it? Shark Attack?
Shark Attack?
Shark
something.
Tank?
You can't say Shark
something.
Tank. That's right. Probably
Shark Attack, yes. It's totally unrelated. Related to Shark Tank, where it's a bunch of entrepreneurs and a bunch of investors get together and kind of see if there's a love connection.
Well, it's entrepreneur investor time of year, apparently, because next week we're at Venture Atlanta.
That's right. A big event for us. That's 2 days at the Aquarium, where we'll be interviewing some of the company spotlight at Venture in Atlanta who are trying to raise some serious funds.
That's going to be a blast. Nothing compared to what we're going to do today, though.
No, I'm excited about today's show.
This is going to be a fun show. On Atlanta Business Radio, we often will have an eclectic mix of guests, and we have a studio full. And in fact, one of our guests brought his entire entourage. So a little bit later in the program, we are going to hear from Phil Marlowe. Okay. But we're going to try to be quiet for a little while.
All right.
But we'll bring you and some of your entourage on in a little bit and learn all about your organization. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce from a firm called NimbleWise, Angie and Jason. Welcome to the show, gang.
Thank
well,
you.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having us.
We are delighted to have you.
I think you guys win best company name. Can you talk a little bit about how you came up with that name? Because I'm a big fan.
We came up with that name after about a half day of contemplation. Our main concern was representing the notion that we've got a team of people who have experience, and that's where the word wise comes from. And then we're a lot more fleet-footed and ready to sort of flex to what our clients need than the firms from which we came. So NimbleWise sort of was born.
So your firm is a consulting firm?
Yes, it is.
So you have to be nimble, right? Because
right.
You have to adjust to whatever's happening, but you also have to be wise to make the right calls.
Right.
It's a great job.
Thank you.
Now, which one's nimble and which one's wise? Or you both carry both banners?
I'm putting my money on Angie.
Right.
So far, me
Jason's
too.
Jason's wise and I'm nimble.
So, Jason, what compelled you to get involved with this particular company? You surely had plenty of choices, yeah?
Right, yeah. Well, Angie and I actually, we come from similar backgrounds. In our old life, we were working at the same firm, and that's how we got to know one another there. And as life often does, it takes people in very different directions. Angie left our previous employer and ended up starting her own firm, NimbleWise, and about a year and a half later, I decided that I was going to go a little bit different direction as well, and the flexibility, again, that she was offering with NimbleWise and the opportunity there just was a really, really good fit for what I was trying to do at the time. I'd actually left the corporate world, and I was going to try my hand in small business radio. So I did a small business radio show here in Atlanta, talking economics, politics, a lot of fun stuff like that, and able to have some flexibility into my schedule was very important at that time. So I could do the radio on the side and then also continue to do the consulting work that I had experience in and that I enjoyed doing.
Well, she had to be flexible just to live up to the branding, right? If she's
going to
be
truth.
Nimble.
So yes, we're nimble with our clients and with our people.
So management consulting, that is a broad banner. What exactly kinds of problems are you trying to solve or needs are you trying to meet?
Well, those are completely dependent upon what the clients bring to us. But generally, we work with a lot of very large companies like AT&T and Alcoa and Cox Communications, and the list goes on. And this is the type of environment we're used to working in and always have. So I think that the most common problems today have to do with business intelligence and operational intelligence and making sure that individual decision makers have the data and the information that they need in order to make those big decisions.
Now, how do you even know that they have this problem? Like, how do they even know to call you? There's like a gazillion management consultants. Is it just your relationships you've built over time?
It is, yes. We win work from Deloitte, KPMG, et cetera, Accenture, Hitachi Consulting. We have friends at all those firms as well, and sometimes they bring us in to partner with them. But for the most part, we find them as competitors in that marketplace. So most of our clients come to us through by way of existing relationships. And
but how do you, to me, that's a big challenge. Like if I'm with a big company, I'm with AT&T. Part of me is kind of, I want to survive in my kind of ecosystem there, and I want to get promoted and continue my career. And it would seem like it's a risk to hire you guys as opposed to Deloitte. Like if I hired Deloitte and they screw up, it's like, well, it's Deloitte. I can't, it's not my bad. But if I take a risk with a small firm, how do I kind of, you know, how do you give me cover on that?
That's a good question. It's an easy answer, too. The difference between us and those other big firms is that we take the people who are at the senior manager and above level,
right,
and we actually put them on the job. The other firms are putting those people over the job, and they're staffing up with a large pyramid of people who are less experienced. So we produce Deloitte-type people, or you know, the same caliber person, but they're actually put on the job.
So they're doing the actual work.
Yes.
And then so the Deloitte person, I'm getting the kid that's just out of college.
Exactly.
But I'm just getting the Deloitte brand just to make me seem like I made the safe choice.
Right.
Nicely played.
Yeah. Seems like you've thought that through.
And I think one advantage of the model that we're working with is the typical burn rate that we use, the amount of budget that we eat into on these projects tends to be a lot lower than some of the bigger firms because we are very deliverable-oriented. We try to address the concerns that the clients need. We're not necessarily staffing 10, 20, 30 people on a project with 8-hour-plus-day shifts that are just burning through budgets. We're very concerned with delivering what the client needs. So I think that clients look at that favorably. And then as Angie said, typical to anybody in the professional services business, we're not selling a product, we're selling people. And once we've established trust and relationships with the clients, then they're very likely to bring us on for additional work or recommend us to other folks that might need similar services. So as long as you build that relationship and maintain that relationship, then it's very easy to win additional projects and additional work.
It is. And practically speaking, you know, Jason and I both were in management at a large firm, and we'd sit there in a room every Friday with the entire management team, and we'd look at resources and schedule, and we'd plug people to days. With NimbleWise, we plug individuals to projects. So to Jason's point, how that would play out is that a person might go out to the client for 2 hours because there's 2 hours of work to do that day, as opposed to hitting the charge code for an entire day's worth of, you know, scheduled time. So we burn through the client budgets a lot more slowly with more experienced people.
I bet that is unique in the marketplace. I've never even come across that model. And, of course, I'm not a management consultant, but I've been married to one for 20-plus years. And they charge at least by the day, if not the week or the month, for her time. That's got to be a tremendous advantage. Can you walk us through a project? I'm particularly interested in the front end on how the project gets framed and what happens in the early stages of the project to set the foundation like this. I mean, don't expect you to name any names if you don't want to, but I'd be real interested, and I think our listeners would too, just to kind of get a feel for what at least the front end of that engagement cycle looks like.
Okay. It tends to start with a complaint or a concern from the client. And so I think, like, we're about to start a project where we've been talking to the buyer for over a year. Just as a peer and a friend. So we're providing ideas and input and advice all along as a friend. And then
Without charging?
Just because we go to lunch, we talk.
Right.
And we're not in a sales role, we're in an advisory role. So we provide that with or without a statement of work. And then eventually it just evolves into the point where the client says, okay, we need this kind of help,
so
and we need
to down.
Ramp up.
You're going
to
wear them down.
Yeah, we wear them down.
And if I could add a little bit to that, I think another sharp distinction between NimbleWise and some of the other larger firms is that we're not out there necessarily trying to sell a product or sell a solution to these companies. We take the approach of listening to what their problems are and then trying to provide advice and consulting from that perspective, and that tends to resonate very strongly with the clients as well.
So you have to be pretty patient.
Yes, this is the same way that that Jason and I identified, scoped, and closed work at our firms. And we might have called it, you know, the grassroots approach. And maybe there was some pressure to walk around with our collateral and our brochures and say, look what we can provide. Or, you know, you go into a meeting. I see this with other consultants because we often end up working with other consultancies for our clients. And we'll be in a meeting and a client will say, well, we have this problem. And they're so quick to say, oh, we solved that problem for this company. And so they're very, you know, just excited to beat their brand or their solutions. And we just are there as a friend and a
you're
supporter.
Like kind of listening. You're just listening, gathering information, and then just seeing if there's a fit
sharing
or not.
Sharing ideas.
Right.
So we won't say, oh, we've done that here. We might say, well, we saw this type of problem elsewhere, and this is how they solved it. So we're actually giving the intelligence instead of bragging that we have it.
Now, do you see a lot of the same kinds of business issues cropping up over and over from client to client? And you guys look at each other and kind of roll your eyes and go, okay, here we go again.
Absolutely. I mean, there are no two clients that are the same, but there are a lot of very, very similar problems across organizations. And I would have to say probably the most common is just how to manage secure information and take information. Whether you're in the manufacturing industry, the telecom industry, the healthcare industry, our clients are dealing with a lot of information. And the challenge that a lot of them have is how to take the information they're collecting and turn it into knowledgeable, actionable information that they can actually use. And a lot of times there are breakdowns in either the collection process or transforming that information into something that's usable, or even the distribution of that information. Internal reporting is a big challenge that a lot of people have. So how can we give management visibility to make knowledgeable decisions? That seems to be a challenge that a lot of companies have, or an area that they just want to improve upon.
I would say, too, that all business problems are really just people problems, and people are disorganized, they're political, they're self-protective, they're isolationist, they don't work together very well always. And so regardless of what industry they're in or what specific technical issues they're facing, there are some universals, and we can help with those. And certainly business intelligence and being prepared to make informed decisions is one of the big ones right now, because everybody's talking about big data.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard about this. And all these years, we've learned how to collect data, but many companies haven't been able to actually leverage it. So, and as a management information systems major 12 years ago, we talked all about all this data that was available, and I have yet to see a client that's using it the way we talked about in school. So,
and now data is being accumulated at a pace that you couldn't even imagine 12 years ago.
Right, right. We have one client who, just to solve one problem, it was a manufacturing client, and they're looking at excursions where their process goes off of what they might call the golden batch or the ideal path, which anytime you have a delay, then you have you waste raw materials and also productivity. So an excursion is a big deal, and when one happens, it can cost $3 million, just one excursion. So they want to identify what happened, and just to investigate one excursion, they had two statisticians and PhDs in certain types of engineering, metallurgy specifically, and they went to 11 different systems, pulled together 169 different variables, and correlated those together to investigate that. And there are solutions today that would enable that kind of a correlation and analysis in real time.
Wow. And then how long did it take them to actually complete that?
It took about 6 weeks for them to pull it all together and do the analysis. And then
and the money is just clicking away there, huh?
Right.
That's that burn rate that Jason was talking about, right? I mean, you can eat into that in a hurry. Now, both of you guys, you had this thing totally dialed in when you were working for the big company. You had the keys to the executive washroom. What in the world were you thinking? Why did you go out on your own?
I think we're both rogues. We each left for different reasons and found each other again. We always stayed in contact, but the reason why I left was to start NimbleWise. I didn't have the name yet. I knew that if I could identify a project with a client, scope it out, close the deal, manage the execution of the project, bill the client, hound the client when they don't pay on time, I kind of figured I had it all down and I would succeed. I was rudely awakened when I left and thought, oh, I'll go sell some work now, because I had underestimated the importance of the partners at the firm that I'd worked for and their relationships. And so it took about 4 months to wake up and realize that I don't need to go pounding doors with solutions. I need to go do what I always did, which is talk to people I know and let them tell me about their problems. And so we kind of found our groove, and then Jason joined a little bit after
that.
And
I think that Angie and I are both very entrepreneurial in spirit, and there is some benefit to starting small and then creating something. I think that there's a lot of just fun involved with doing that. There are certainly a lot of benefits to working with a larger firm, but to be able to create the culture and the company from the ground up is, at least for me, it's a lot of fun.
It is.
Now, what is the biggest challenge now in your growth? Because at first you said the challenge was, I guess, getting the pipeline filled. Now that seems like the pipeline's pretty filled, and then you had to bring on Jason. What are the challenges you're facing now as you grow?
So the biggest challenge, and I likened it, because people will say that they're drinking from a fire hose, and I feel like I have a key to all the fire hydrants in the city, mm-hmm. and it's just a matter of, do I have time to go open them all and take a sip? Because so many opportunities are just flooding past us, and the biggest growing pain is, you know, saying yes to a project and then looking around at the current resources we have and saying, wow, we need to get more resources. And so it's just that balance of committing to clients and having the right people. Once we have people on board, we need to commit to them also. So
right. So then, but that seems like a big challenge because you're dealing with senior people that are actually the boots
expensive.
On the ground,
yes.
right?
And they're expensive.
Right. So you can't just have them on the bench just sitting there
exactly.
waiting. So you got to kind of balance the work with the people and keeping each of them kind of fulfilled.
Right. And the extra complication is that we want people like us, not necessarily with the same exact skills, but certainly who have other things going on.
Though,
yes.
Right.
We don't want someone who is looking to us to provide the full-time 100%, income and professional fulfillment. We're looking for other rogues. Mm-hmm. So people who want to serve clients and they want to be busy when they're busy, and then they want to do something else with their time, whether it's for pleasure or for business.
So is that hard to find?
Yes. It is, because people are used to the cozy comfort of having a job with a salary and specific type of benefits and this many days off and all that. So you have to be an entrepreneur if you want to.
Now, is the industry changing to more rogues?
I think there are more people who are willing to rethink that model, but it's surprising how many people are still stuck. I think we've talked to people, Jason and I, who we used to work with, who will say, you know, I'd love to do what you're doing, but I just can't imagine giving all this up. And we're thinking, okay, commuting during the worst time of the day
right.
and having to be in meetings that aren't productive and burning time when you're not really actually doing anything.
Right.
What are you giving up, you know? What you get by moving into a model like this is time to do other things as well. So whether it's reading or writing or, you know, learning how to cook or whatever is your passion. So
in addition to securing additional work, you're also actively always have your eye open, your ear to the ground for talent that will fit into your culture?
Absolutely.
So talk a little bit about this concept of yours that you characterize as engineering value. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. So a lot of our clients are trying to build a case that management can buy off on. So, for example, in the manufacturing environment, if they're looking to put in an information system that will allow them, instead of having to do a postmortem on an excursion and go to 11 different sources, maybe they can bring it all into one, but they need to make a big investment, maybe a $6 million investment or more. So how do they convince the CFO that he should write that check? Well, they have to build a business case. And so it's not an effort of computing ROI. We're not talking about a little software tool that you can easily say, here's your ROI, you'll save $20
right.
here. We're talking about showing where the value is, not the value of the tools or the program that they're proposing, but the value of the actions that they would take that would be enabled by those tools. So we have to go to... for example, again, manufacturing environment, we have to go to the reliability people and the maintenance people and whoever's in charge of the sustainability and environmental program and help them sort of figure out what would they do if they had this solution that they want to put in, what would they do with that? And then sort of determine, well, what's the value of that in money usually, or some other overarching enterprise level objective.
But are you asking them to take a path that they've never taken before, or are they just tweaking an existing path?
They are, it depends on what they're trying to accomplish. So one client wanted to put in, and I can talk about them specifically. This is Alcoa, which is an aluminum manufacturer.
We'll have to send them a bill. First
okay.
No, that's great. Go ahead.
And they had some really great leaders in their organization that wanted to put in what they called smart manufacturing. And smart manufacturing includes, you know, for them, it would include an investment in this this operational intelligence system.
Right.
As well
and
as
have
some
they
other
have
infrastructure.
Any operational intelligence?
Of course. They, so they do have. One of the engineers said something so great. He's one of those French-speaking Montreal mm-hmm. folks. He said, the data are available and patiently waiting for us. So it's all there. The data is all there. All
right.
The valves and fans, everything's got a meter on it, and it's collecting data. All the assets are collecting data,
right.
But nobody can get to it unless they get the statisticians and all these smart people
right.
together and burn a lot of time. So so it's something that... you know, they pull it all together in one place and put together a way to analyze that. And that was just one piece of the smart manufacturing vision. And so we helped them build a business case for that vision in a way that made sense to management. So here's where we're going to save on energy. Here's where you're going to optimize your manpower. Take people who are smart and could be doing other things
right.
off of this and onto value-added activities. And then eventually rolling that up to a dollar number.
So you helped them make the case, but did you help them implement it, or your job ends when they've made the case?
What we do in this type of project is we come back after they've implemented it and help them measure the value and prove, and we can, in some cases, for other clients, we've been asked to audit,
mm-hmm.
so to come in and actually validate that they got the value that they said they would or that they're continuing to get
right.
the value.
So you make the case, and then you audit it afterwards
right.
to make sure that it's doing what you...
Right, if they want us to, yeah.
Right.
In some cases, we're part of the... we've got another client who we're part of that team to build the program out, but we're not the technical people who put in the software or
right.
even really know how to analyze that data, but we can help set the vision and communicate it.
Jason, in the not too distant past, I found an individual running a really interesting company. It was profitable. It was a lot of fun to do. And this person was a lot smarter than me. I sense you and I have a real connection here. I think you were able to pull off the same thing, weren't you?
That's the truth. It's always good to know really smart people, right?
So are you having fun? Because you haven't been at it that long on this recent run here.
Right. Well, the work that we're doing is not new.
Right.
I mean, we have multiple years of doing this line of work, but it's certainly a lot of fun, and it's fun when you can do it with somebody that you enjoy working with as well.
Now, Angie, your workforce is virtual, I would imagine. You don't all come to an office to do work, right?
If we're in the office, it means we're not at a client.
So you spend more time at the actual client?
Yes.
And are your clients all over the world, all over the country?
They are all over the country. We've got two that we're cooking up in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of our, most of our clients have operations elsewhere in the world. So we have had some international travel, but we generally haven't worked with companies that are headquartered outside of this continent
mm-hmm.
yet.
But no. That's yet.
Yet.
Depends where Angie wants to visit.
Well, what I was going to
exactly.
say is you have personal expertise in risk management. How have you capitalized on that to manage the risk in building your own organization?
Oh, that's a tough one because we were talking about this a few minutes ago. We know how to work with big companies, but we don't work with small companies. And so this is our first time working with a small one, and it's ours. And we know certain things are broken or certain controls aren't in place or there's certain inefficiencies there. But we can't draw on the same types of tools.
So the rules are different for small companies and big companies?
A little bit. I think that if I recall back in our days working for the firms, we would always laugh about how broken our own internal processes were. So maybe it's not so much internal, small versus large as it is, you know, we're always client focused, our own
right, the
inside.
Cobbler's children
right.
kind of scenario.
Right. So I remember one of the companies that I worked for, you know, it would take hours to pull together just your time and expense reports and things like that. And yet we would go and advise clients on how to have
that
efficient
real time
systems.
What are you crazy? It takes you all day to get that?
but when we're, you know, if you think about it, we can go advise our clients at a high level. We might be working with the CFO or executive director of management reporting or whatever. Whereas in our own organization, we're just, you know, we're inventory. Right? We're part of the product. So
Well,
we're not in those conversations where we can improve our
business. You're in multiple
business.
Little boxes on the org chart.
Right. Right.
Sure. So, and I think also, just like our clients, that a lot of times we know what the problems are. It's just a matter of having the adequate resources to address all the problems. And then within that, you have to prioritize what you want to attack. And for us right now, it's serving our clients, selling work, and then some of the back office activities we're having to play a little bit of catch up with. But I think that is something that any small business experiences.
Right. Well, I would imagine that client loyalty and customer service are your strong suits. And how do you just keep them happy and engaged after the project's over so that you get kind of repeat business?
We never leave.
You never leave? Is that what happens, is that, you know, you do a good job and then they kind of look at you as part of the team?
Well, while we're deliverable focused in the sense that we don't just burn time, we always become part of the team in some way. So mm-hmm. every client, even if we don't have anything to do for them presently, we always have a reason to call them and keep the conversation going. So there are clients where we don't currently have a presence, where we have had a past presence, but that's just because we're dormant with them. There's nothing to do, but they'll call us when it's time.
But they're not on the clock anymore.
Right.
You're just on hiatus.
Right.
But relationships are the lifeblood of this business, like they are most. It sounds like you guys have got a good handle on this thing.
And I think fundamentally, Angie and I both enjoy solving problems. So a lot of the larger firms, they won't even initiate these conversations until they are a little bit farther down the road trying to get a statement of work or at least some sort of guarantee that something's going to come out of it. Angie and I like to hear what problems the clients are having, and then we're more than happy to provide advice free of charge oftentimes in order to try to build that relationship and that trust again, and that tends to lead on to a lot of more sustainable work in these longer term relationships.
Right. See, clients never go away. They're just gone hiatus.
Right.
And then they re-engage when they need you.
We don't respond to RFPs.
You don't?
No.
So that's a rule?
Well, if
philosophy
if they,
of the company?
It's a philosophy, yeah.
Because it's what? Because it's remedial work and it's not going to be as fun.
It's
and
transactional. You're not interested in transactions like that?
Well, sometimes an RFP will be for a very, very large consulting engagement, but it's just a thing going out to the public that all the providers are running around trying to respond to.
Right.
And when you respond to an RFP, you're just going in cold with your solution without really knowing what the client's problem is.
Right.
So we feel we're already set up to not
so if they
serve
ask,
them the
you
way
say
they need
no,
to be
we
served.
Don't do that?
Well, if we have a client who needs to go through that procurement just from a formality perspective, then we'll fill out the paperwork. But
and help them write
generally,
it.
We've already been asked to do the work before it's time for an RFP.
Yeah, or get in there and help them write the RFP so that you're the only one that can meet the criteria.
That's your philosophy.
It is my philosophy. Absolutely.
Maybe you can call them up. They need talent.
My experience has been that when, if procurement is in charge of,
I know where this is
selecting
going.
The vendor, then it's you know already the client isn't going to get exactly what they need.
Right.
The client, the business should be defining what they need and whom they need to do it, and then the procurement is a business control to make sure that everything is on the up and up and that there's no
right. But they shouldn't be the drivers.
Exactly, and if they are driving it, then we probably don't want to be involved.
So what's the best way for a senior executive or a maverick consultant to reach out to you guys and have a conversation on some of these topics?
Probably by email, wouldn't you say, Jason?
Absolutely. Email's the best, jason.riddle@nimblewise.com.
And angela.levy@nimblewise.com.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you in the studio this morning.
Thank you. We
got to have you back because there's so much to talk about. I think it'd be fun if we could pull it off maybe to come in with a client sometime.
That would be great.
I'd love to
I've
hear.
One in
do you have local clients?
We have
do.
Anybody here? I mean, don't you think that would make for a great show?
Yeah, I think because I think you're doing something in a different way. And, you know, people should know that there's, you know, I think you're getting the best of both worlds with your firm. You're getting all of the intelligence you need, but you're also getting it in a format that's just customizable and perfectly solves a solution.
Well, and I really like this nimble, agile approach. Right. It's not just marketing for you guys. You're very serious about serving people in that way. And believe me, I know that burn rate can stack up in a hurry. So, yeah, I'd like to put that together sometime.
Okay.
I think that'd be fun.
Yeah, we'd love to. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, how about hanging out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
Sounds great.
Terrific. Well, next up on Atlanta Business Radio, Lee, is a gentleman with IOU Central. And you probably don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Why don't you tell us?
I'm going to say it like you would say it, and we'll see if you had it right. So please welcome to the show, Phil Marlowe.
Yep, that's perfect.
Exactly.
Phil Marlowe. Yep.
So now you know.
Thank you.
Well, welcome to the show, Phil and Entourage. You also win Best Dressed. You've got this sport jacket on instead of the sweatshirts like the rest of us.
Thank you.
So what exactly do you owe me, IOU Central?
Well, IOU Central is, well, IOU, like the acronym kind of explains it. We are a internet-based, online small business lender. And essentially we make small business loans that range between $5,000 to $100,000. To small businesses across America.
Oh, really? So it's just U.S. based?
Yes, it's just U.S. based.
And so how'd you get in this business? You got a big pile of money? What this about?
No, I just basically caught on to a trend, which is really alternative lending. Essentially, what's happening in the economy today is banks are really not fulfilling their role in today's economy as providers of credit.
Right, but they have piles of money, right?
Yeah, piles of money, but
they're making it too difficult to give it out.
Right, they're making it very difficult to give it out because their credit standards are actually are either too strict or the just a lot of our businesses, for example, we're doing what we call micro loans, which are loans between $5,000 to $100,000.
So $100,000 is a micro loan?
Is a micro loan, yeah. I mean, by yeah.
I like this guy. Like a small little piece of business I want to talk to you about after
right.
the show.
Well, the SBL defines a loan that goes up to $1 million as a small business loan.
Right.
And a micro loan, a loan between $0 and $100,000. So just kind of taking that. But banks don't want to do these smaller micro type loans because they say they're just not worth their while. There's just too much bureaucracy and red tape, and actually they just don't make enough money making a small $25,000 loan.
Right.
So, or their clients don't have a lot of our clients don't have a lot of hard collateral. They're merchants. They're really in the service business. They're hospitality businesses.
Right.
They're dental offices or medical offices. So again, banks don't really play in that area. So what happens is when a client shows up at a bank and says, I want a loan, and they're turned down, there's really nowhere else to go right now. There's an
well,
alternative.
Well, now they're you.
Yeah, now they're us, exactly.
So now, can you walk us through what happens? I go to my bank, and I say I need a micro loan of $75,000, and they're like, nope, sorry, too many hoops to jump through. It's not worth my time. So I call you guys up, and then what are you doing to check me out?
Well, what we do is we, first of all, you go online. Go to the
It all happens online?
All online. You go to our website, IOUcentral.com.
Okay.
You apply. You basically fill out, an online application. It takes about 10 minutes to fill out.
Okay.
And essentially, once you submit, basically, you give us permission to access or source the cloud, which is a fancy way of saying all this data.
Right.
And we recreate the borrower's financial profile in real time. So really, we're technology powered. I mean, that's really how we're solving, a lot of these.
So you check me out. You check my credit score. You check what are you checking?
Well,
me?
I mean, we check your credit data. So we pull in the business's credit data. We pull in the owner's credit data.
Right.
We check banking data.
Right.
It's kind of their banking transactions. All their cash flow and whatnot. We also check social data. So for example, if it's a restaurant, we'll look at their Yelp ratings. If it's a e-commerce store or an actual store that sells through, an e-commerce platform like eBay.
Right.
We'll actually get their eBay ratings,
right.
So et cetera, et cetera. So we're really recreating, essentially what we're doing is recreating the borrower's profile in real time.
And then you have that data now, and then what happens?
Then what happens is we run this through our algorithm, essentially. So, and we assign that business what we call an IOU score. So it's a proprietary credit score. Risk score, I should say, that we've kind of devised based on a multi-factor model, and essentially that'll allow us to, actually either approve or decline that client.
So as a small business owner, how do I know when it's time to start thinking about borrowing money? Are there some criteria or some events in the business or some things that say, you know what, Lee, maybe we ought to take a look at this and borrow a little money?
I think it really comes down to, you know, a lot of these, you know, small businesses sometimes have, you know, either they have a boost in demand, so they need more inventory, or they didn't budget correctly and they're saying, you know what, it's the summer's coming and I want to expand, I want to put out a patio. I'd like to get some money to do that to generate more business. Or there's an opportunity. You know, we do a lot, for example, an auto mechanic store. There's an opportunity to buy a truck at, say, 60 or 70 cents on the dollar, but that opportunity won't last, so he needs the money quickly.
Right.
So he'll come to see us because you got to remember, our decisions are done in the clients that come to us for loans can get funded in, you know, as little as 2 business days.
So wow. not just approved, but actually a check in their hand?
A check funded, yes. They would have the money in 2 business days. So the money's allocated to you. You know, click on accept, review your terms, and the money would get transferred in 2 to 3 business days. So within a week, they have the funds in their account, and they can actually move forward with their project.
So purely hypothetically, I'd like to run a little scenario with you. Suppose there was a good, solid business that's profitable, but one of the partners had a less than stellar credit rating. Had they got a better shot at getting some money through your system than they would down at a typical bank?
Look, they can try. They can try to go to a typical bank, but a typical bank will cost you in their time. It'll cost you. They have to have a full application, which costs you 5 or 6 days of their actual time, which is basically they're not managing their business. And even once the bank receives the application, it could take them, you know, 3 to 6 months before they make a decision on whether or not they would lend you the money. So what happens is if you have an opportunity,
right, it's gone.
It's
that,
gone.
That truck sold to somebody else.
Exactly. So you just you're left.
Time is the big advantage, but what about, is it possible, though, if you don't meet the criteria that the standard banks want, maybe your credit rating's a little bit low, or maybe they just don't understand business as much, or they don't believe in your business model, have you got a little better shot with your lenders, or not necessarily?
No, you do. You do for sure, because, you know, we have clients, either the client doesn't have, you know, the any collateral, or the client's, the owner's credit, like you're saying, is less than perfect.
Right.
So they have a better shot, because we're actually looking holistically at the whole, at the business. So we're looking at, you know, a lot of our loans are really, you know, cash flow based loans. So we're looking at how much money is coming in. Because what we do uniquely that a lot of, you know, other lenders don't do is we collect our payments daily. So we look at the cash flow generating ability of these businesses on a daily basis. Because they're selling daily, a lot of our, you know, most of our clients,
right,
we actually collect our payments daily. So there's a matching of an exact matching of the cash flow. So it's a very good budgeting tool for a lot of these businesses.
So then that's why you go back and kind of review all their ratings and things like that so you can tell if these guys are really historically doing a good job day after day.
Right, day after day. If, you know, they have to have been in business for, you know, a few years, so we can capture enough data, because our decisions are based on data. Just, you know that's kind of the crux of our model, basically.
Right.
So they have to have been in business for a few years, so we can capture a lot of data that demonstrates their ability to service these loans.
Do you do only loans or credit lines as well?
Only loans. So that's really our core product.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to invite Robert into this conversation as well. First of all, I want to make sure this guy's representing everything properly. Is he doing a good job, Robert?
He's doing a great job. Thanks.
So tell us a little bit about your role with this outfit.
So Phil and I met back in 2008 and put these two companies together and we were running an operations here and lending for the last 20 years and had worked with a lot of the big banks and understood where the deficiencies could lie in a bank and the regulatory issues facing banks. And so we saw this opportunity to lend to small businesses and help these small businesses out without having to deal with a lot of the bureaucracy that we're having to deal with in a traditional lending sense.
So the technology is really the foundation for this whole thing.
Technology is the cornerstone of the business, because that's how you're solving this whole, you know, a lot of these banks don't lend because the loans are too small. There's too much, you know, there's too much manual labor involved in making those loans. So when we went out and looked at the landscape, we said the way to solve this problem, you know, you got to remember a majority, I would say, of all small businesses who apply for a loan to bank or refuse for either less than perfect credit, no collateral, or by the way, the loan's too small. So the only way to solve that is with technology, because technology essentially allows you to scale and keep your costs very low.
Now, is technology your marketing path as well, or are you out? How are you even getting on the radar of like the small businesses?
Google AdWords.
No, we don't. Yeah, we don't leverage the Google AdWords as much. We deal with a lot of banks. You know, a lot of banks that they want to help their customers.
Oh, they kick you the opportunity.
They can't necessarily help them.
Oh,
and
nice.
And the idea is the banks want to help those customers, but they don't have a product or a solution for them. So they'll send those customers to us.
But your business comes from all over the country, right?
That's correct. So we'll deal with small business loan brokers. We'll deal with the merchant processing companies that are selling these companies their credit card processing equipment. And they'll get the word out that if they need capital, they should turn to us as an alternative solution.
It's a lot of referral business coming into to our site, basically.
But how do you work, like, say, the Atlanta market? Do you become buddies with all the merchant service kind of sellers and the bankers here in town?
Absolutely.
So you do that market by market?
Market by market.
So you have salespeople in all the markets doing the same kind
Correct.
Of exercise?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what's the biggest challenge for you guys right now? Are you trying to grow? Are you meeting with some competition? People are looking at what you're doing and think, man, these guys, you know, Robert and these guys are, they got a good idea here. Are they competing with you?
Right. I guess the biggest, is we want to grow our business, and the biggest challenge is to stay focused and disciplined and to keep true to the product, basically, and the guidelines that we've set for ourselves.
But don't get high on your own supply.
Right.
You don't borrow money, right?
Well, we do borrow money in order to lend it back out. So just like banks do, they borrow money to lend it back out. So we do it conservatively. We don't over leverage ourselves and overextend ourselves. But we do a bit of that for sure.
Now, are your customers? Do they come from, like, as you mentioned, restaurants? Are there a certain sweet spot for you from a customer standpoint who uses your service more than others?
I think there's a lot of, we get a lot of dental offices. We have a lot of medical offices, a lot of hospitality industry, such as restaurants, hotels, spas. We do a little bit of retail. I think that's, kind of a good chunk of our business. Service, auto mechanics, service stores.
Why do you think dental is in there? Because I guess
they don't go to business school,
right? I think
cash flow.
I think a lot of times what happens is they don't budget themselves correctly, and so they find out they get stuck, and they say, you know what, I have all this old equipment, I got to upgrade, and I didn't budget for this, mm-hmm. and I need to get a loan to replace all my equipment, right. my old equipment. And you got to remember, one of the unique things that we do is getting paid back daily. But when you get paid back daily because they're getting paid back daily because it's kind of matching the cash flow, what you're doing is budgeting on their behalf. So you're putting money aside for them every single day so that they can make that monthly, they can make that daily payment versus other traditional loans, which you're basically forcing, a lot of the times they forget to put money aside to make that monthly payment. So, what we're doing is really helping them budget for them. So
golf is expensive.
Golf.
And dentists have to play golf. Well, I don't figure that into their budget.
Right. Golf doesn't play itself,
But no, I don't want to dismiss this. This matching to the cash flow, you're actually giving them the structure that they need, not only to pay you back, but it's probably helping them run a more profitable business.
Absolutely. It's a much more responsible way of borrowing because you're actually making them pay back a little bit every day until the loan is repaid versus other type of loans.
And I think the convenience factor is big as well. So being able to apply for the loan after hours, after business hours, and do it in a short 10-minute process, understand very quickly what the terms are, and in a very non-sales, non-pushy approach is very comforting to a lot of people. And so we see, our average years in business is like 13 years in business and great credit scores, and we will go down deeper in that threshold, but our average customer is very high end, very bankable.
Probably eventually get a loan right down the street at the big bank, but it's just a lot.
They just don't want to wait 6 months.
A lot of times we're a stepping stone for an SBA loan, and so they'll use a small loan to pay off taxes or pay quarterly taxes or real estate taxes, and it shores up their balance sheet for them to be able to go in and get a $2 million SBA loan or whatever they're trying to attempt.
Or if it takes them exactly 3 to 6 months to apply for that, to get that bank loan, will actually act as
a bridge loan, really.
Is there room in this model to serve the startup or emerging enterprise market, or is that still a little hairy and you don't want to play in that world?
It's not. I don't think it's not that we is because our lending decisions are based on data. So when we recreate that profile, we're grabbing, you know, whether it's social data, credit data, banking data, whatever data it is. So at the end of the day, a startup doesn't have any history,
right?
And so it would be very difficult for us to kind of to underwrite that type of deal.
Now, what's the typical term of your loan?
There's two products. So there's a 6 month term and a 12 month term. So, mm-hmm. You know, depending on what meets the needs of the client.
And how'd you come up with that?
I think it's more about, you know, we want to be a short term solution.
Right.
We're not a permanent financing. I mean, a lot of times, like Robert was alluding to, these, you know, borrowers will go, they'll use us as a bridge and then put the permanent financing, which is really your bank financing,
right,
in place after 6 months or a year or whatever it is, to basically, you know, to run their business this way.
And if somebody wanted to learn more, you have a website?
Yes, we do. It's www.iouCentral.com.
And if you're in the United States, your possible solution. And
yes,
it just takes a few minutes to fill out the form, and they'll get their answer within a day or so?
Within 48 hours, they should have it.
And a yes or no answer.
That's unbelievable. This is a godsend. For the right people that meet the right criteria, I mean, this is fantastic.
Yep, good stuff. Well, I appreciate you guys being part of the show. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next week on Atlanta Business Radio.